Hello and welcome to Volume 45, Number 24 of Grapevine, your weekly local news magazine. Brought to you by the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association, this edition is published on Friday the 12th of June 2026. Hi, I'm Andrew, your presenter, and I'm joined this week by Margaret C and Andy, and with the help and assistance from Engineer Stephen. And in the news this week, changes to how local ambulances work, Galston Beach sewage still causing issues, and anyone fancy a snail wheel? We have two birthdays this week, both for the same day, Wednesday the 17th. So our very best wishes go out to Diane Edwards and also to Edna Gurney. Best wishes to you both. OK, time for the first part of the local news with Margaret C and Andy.
Hello, and now we have this week's news, and it's Margaret and Andrew, and Margaret's going to start for you.
Hello, everybody. Well, looking out of the window, you'd think it was November, not June, but never mind. They do say the weather will improve next week. We live in hope. Now, for my first news item, here we go. So if you're sitting comfortably, I'll begin. They say one doesn't make a summer, but far fewer swallows are flashing through our skies as the warmer months arrive. Research by the Thetford-based British Trust for Ornithology, BTO, reveals numbers have plummeted by more than a third across East Anglia. It blames changes in farming practices, which have decimated the insects, the tiny birds, which migrate to our shores from sub-Saharan Africa, depend on for food for themselves and their young. Viola Ross-Smith, the BTO's science communications manager, said its breeding bird surveys showed swallow numbers fell by 38% across the region between 1995 and 2023. We've seen intensification of arable farming, which contributes to declines in the insect prey swallows rely on, and also reductions in grazed grassland associated with livestock farming, which again provides good habitat for swallows to hunt for insect prey, she said. She added, while climate change was also a factor, there could still be hope for the summer visitors if we gave them a helping hand. Leaving areas of our land or gardens wild and avoiding the use of insecticides and other chemicals can help to boost their food supplies. The surge in barns, stables and other rural buildings being converted into homes and holiday lets has also seen many sites where the birds would build their mud nests under the eaves lost. Dr. Ross Smith said, swallows traditionally nest in barns, stables and other outbuildings. So if you're lucky enough to have one of those, think about making sure swallows can still nest there before doing them up. You can install artificial nests for them too if you need to do some building work. The raw material the birds use for nest building is also hard to come by during dry springs, like the one our region was experiencing until recent days. Erratic weather can also affect the emergencies of the flying insects while they catch on the wing.
And what about the ambulance service? A health union has criticised plans by the region's ambulance service to take fewer patients to hospital and monitor the amount of time crews spend with them. The East of England Ambulance Service, shortened to EAST, says taking every patient to hospital is no longer the most effective approach. It believes the change will allow it to deliver faster emergency responses for the sickest patients and help others to get the right care sooner. And setting targets for the time staff spend at emergencies will mean crews work more efficiently. But, there's always a but, isn't there? But Donna Thomas, regional officer from the GMB union, which represents many ambulance workers, said, East have recently told ambulance staff to spend no longer than 42 minutes at Category 2 calls and have told staff that they will be monitored and performance managed against this time limit. There is a disconnect between the service simultaneously telling staff to spend less time with patients while also aiming to take fewer patients to hospital. Ambulance clinicians should be able to spend time assessing the true needs of patients and given the time to work with local communities to find better pathways for patient care if the patient is not in need of a conveyance to the local emergency department. East says expecting an ambulance to take every patient to hospital is outdated and that a more flexible approach is needed to reduce delays, avoiding unnecessary hospital visits and improve care for those in greatest need. Some people calling 999 will instead be referred to the NHS's 111 number, which may direct them to their GP or mental health services. Staff have also been given targets covering the amount of time they spend at so-called Category 2 emergencies, which include heart attacks, strokes and major burns. They're 70 minutes for patients who are not conveyed to hospital and 42 minutes for those who are. Simon Chase, chief paramedic at East, said, We are changing how care works so patients get the right help first time. An ambulance journey to hospital is not always the best option. What matters is getting the right care quickly and safely. This plan will aim to deliver faster responses for the sickest patients, clearer advice when people call us, and more support closer to home where it is safe to do so. Just as importantly, we are supporting our staff with better training, stronger leadership and improved tools so they can make confident decisions and provide high-quality care. Alex Stewart, Chief Executive of Health Watch Norfolk, said it would welcome any improvements in patient care. But, he added, what we would like to see is evidence of the outcomes that patients have improved moving forwards.
Sewage pollution alerts are in place at Gorston Beach after heavy rainfall. Sewage is currently leaking into the sea. According to Action Against Surfers, the sewage alert in Gorston started at 12:36 a.m. on Tuesday, and they say angling water is responsible. The sewage discharges often result from periods of heavy rainfall, which trigger storm overflow systems to release into the sea. Anglian Water has been contacted for a comment. However, after a recent sewage alert in Norfolk, a spokesman for the company said, We know our customers and communities feel strongly that storm overflow discharges are unacceptable, and we agree. Our long-term goal is to completely stop using storm overflows, but getting there isn't something we can do overnight. We've already removed more than 340 storm overflows from our network entirely, and we're investing £1 billion between now and 2030 to tackle storm spills by installing more stormwater storage and preventing rain and groundwater from getting into our pipes to begin with, making storm overflow activations less likely.
And it's a while since I've had one of these, a cannabis farm. Police are continuing to investigate after cannabis plants worth £260,000 were seized at a property in Great Yarmouth. The drugs were discovered by officers on Wednesday, June the 3rd, in a house on King's Road. In the property, there were 314 plants and growing equipment spread across 17 rooms. A spokesperson for Norfolk Police said, "No arrests have yet been made. Inquiries are ongoing."
A Roy representative has praised the efforts of students at a local secondary school. Deputy Lieutenant of Norfolk, Sarah Foster, visited Ormiston Venture Academy in Galston to see at first hand the school's eco-garden project. During the visit, Miss Foster toured the garden with eco-team members Ruby, Dion, Luke and Jasmine, who shared the project's progress and future plans. The Deputy Lieutenant of Norfolk said, "I enjoyed my visit to Venture enormously." The project, developed in partnership with the Papillon Project, has been running since January 2026 and will continue into the 2026/27 academic year. Ruby, a student at Ormiston Venture Academy, said, "It was brilliant to show a representative of the royal family around our garden and tell them what we have enjoyed so far and also what we have planned for the future." The garden has transformed an outdoor space into a sustainable learning environment, featuring fencing and raised flower beds made from recycled materials. Students have grown a variety of fruit, vegetables and herbs, including potatoes, carrots, rhubarb, raspberries and strawberries, with a focus on biodiversity and well-being. Spencer Doggett, Director of Personal Learning at Ormiston Venture Academy, said, "We were delighted to welcome Sarah Foster to the Academy and showcase the incredible work our students have been undertaking through the Eco Garden Project. We are incredibly grateful to Matt Willer and the Papillon Project for their continued support and look forward to seeing the garden continue to flourish over the coming year." Around 50 students participate in the project each month, gaining practical gardening experience, improving teamwork, and deepening their understanding of environmental sustainability. Working alongside Matt Willer from the Papillon Project, students have developed new skills while contributing to a lasting legacy for the Academy.
And I'm going to apologise in advance for this next piece. It's full of numbers, I'm afraid. But they're quite big ones, and bluntly, it's our money. It concerns a £2.5 million compensation bill. The region's NHS trusts have paid out more than £2.5 million in compensation to staff who sued for workplace injuries over the last 5 years. New figures show that 203 healthcare workers at Norfolk's three main hospitals, its mental health trust and its ambulance service, made claims against their employers between 2020 and 2025. They included cases where staff have been traumatised or injured by events in the workplace, as well as incidents where they've been assaulted. More than half the cases involved employees at the East of England Ambulance Service, which paid out £1,060,016 to settle claims. The data also shows the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in King's Lynn had 22 cases and paid out £858,000. Norfolk and Suffolk NHS Foundation Trust, which runs mental health service, had 34 cases and £380,000 in payments. The James Paget Hospital, 23 cases and £136,000 in settlements. The Norfolk and Norwich Hospital, £101,000 and 21 cases. One payout at the QEH was for more than £750,000. But the nature of the claim and the identity of the staff member has never been made public. Few cases make it into open court where the media can report them, as more than 80% are settled by agreement beforehand, according to NHS Resolution, which oversees disputes. The highest average payments to staff over the 5 years were at the Norfolk and Suffolk Foundation Trust, and that was £11,000, and the ambulance service, £10,300. The data has emerged in a series of Freedom of Information requests by Accident Claims Advice, who are personal injury solicitors. Nationally, slips and trips were the leading cause of staff injury across the entire health service, accounting for 1,763 successful claims submitted over the five-year time frame, which cost the NHS, as we said, £225.8 million in damages. Some 1,021 successful claims were also lodged by staff members who were victims of assault in the workplace, which saw a total damages payment of £18.1 million. Workplace-related mental health issues also proved costly to settle, as while there were 84 claims for stress, they cost the NHS £8.8 million in damages across the period. Patrick Malone, head of workplace accident claims at Accident Claims Advice, said, "To see more than 1,000 health care workers sue the NHS after being assaulted or falling on the job points to a systemic failure of basic workplace protection. Diverting more than £190 million away from patient care to fund injury damages and legal battles is a tragedy for an already cash-strapped service." A spokesman for the region's ambulance service said staff operated in a wide range of challenging and unpredictable environments. Gary O'Hare, Chief Operating Officer at the Norfolk and Suffolk Foundation Trust, said the payouts related to incidents involving challenging behaviour as well as workplace accidents. Deborah O'Hara, Director of People and Culture at the James Paget, said the majority of its cases related to isolated incidents, while David Partridge, Interim Director of People at the NNN, said its cases involved a tiny percentage of its 10,300 staff. Finally, John Sason, Director of People at the QEH Hospital, said that most of its payments involved significantly smaller sums.
A man has been charged after two girls were allegedly raped on a Norfolk beach. Madalin Ilinca, 34, a Romanian national of Stafford Road, Great Yarmouth, was stopped at the port of Dover while re-entering the UK on Sunday, June the 7th. He was arrested on suspicion of rape and sexual offences following reports that two teenage girls had been raped on the town's South Beach at 12:37 a.m. on Saturday, May the 16th. He has since been charged on one count of rape, one count of sexual assault by penetration, and one count of sexual assault. Ilinca is due to appear at Norwich Magistrates Court on Monday, June the 8th. Police had previously said that one of the two suspects in the rape inquiry had fled Norfolk. A second man, also in his 30s, was arrested in Northamptonshire on Monday, May the 17th, on suspicion of rape in connection with the same incident. He remains on police bail until August the 10th, while investigations continue. The force declined to specify the other suspect's nationality when asked.
And I'm back to cannabis again. They're trying to say something about me here. Anyway, a man in his 20s will appear in court after police found almost 400 cannabis plants at a house in Great Yarmouth. Durham Dada, 24, of no fixed address, has been charged with the production of a controlled Class B drug, namely cannabis, and is next due to appear at Norwich Crown Court on June the 15th. This follows police officers attending a property on Main Cross Road in Great Yarmouth on May the 11th, when they discovered around 395 plants. Earlier that day, officers were called to Regent Road, where they found approximately 100 cannabis plants, and a man in his 50s was arrested at the scene on suspicion of cannabis production and taken to Great Yarmouth Police Investigation Centre for questioning. A spokesperson for Norfolk Police said that no further action would be taken against the man following an investigation. The case remains open, however, and inquiries are ongoing.
More than 3,000 people were left without power for hours in villages near Great Yarmouth. UK Power Networks first became aware of the issue at 8:26 a.m. on Saturday, June the 6th. A total of 3,611 villages from Ormsby, Scrapby, California and Caister were all impacted by the problem, which was caused by an underground electricity cable fault. Engineers arrived at about 11 a.m. and the issues were resolved about 4 p.m. when engineers managed to divert power around the underground fault. A spokesman for UK Power Networks has confirmed that further work is still being carried out on overhead cabling, however. Thank you for your patience while our engineers worked hard to resolve this complex issue safely, he added. We apologise that we had to change our time for restoration during the power cut, and we appreciate your understanding.
I've got a sad one, I'm afraid. A kind, loving and caring teenager was found dead in a park just days before Christmas, an inquest heard. A member of the public discovered the body of Carolus Kasinaukos in Great Yarmouth Bure Park on December 22nd last year. Despite attempts from emergency service workers to save him, including police and paramedics, the agency worker died at the scene as a result of hanging. A statement from his family read to Norfolk Coroner's Court described Mr. Kasinaukos as having a good sense of humour as well as being kind, caring and loving. It added that he seemed normal on the day before his death and was asking what to bring for Christmas. Born on August 26, 2006, in Kelm, Lithuania, the teenager lived on North Quay. Following his death, a police investigation confirmed there were no suspicions of any third-party involvement. The court heard Mr. Kasinaukos had no diagnosed mental health conditions nor any physical issues. However, toxicology findings included in a post-mortem report noted that he had a blood alcohol concentration of 148 milligrams per 100 milliliters, almost twice the legal limit for driving in England. Area Coroner Joanna Thompson came to a brief narrative conclusion that Mr. Kasinaukos took his own life while under the influence of alcohol. She expressed her condolences to his family and friends.
New planters have been installed in the town's marketplace. Great Yarmouth Borough Council, GYBC, has placed two new wooden containers with plants in the piazza end of the marketplace in the town centre. A Facebook post from GYBC said, "A touch of greenery has arrived in the marketplace. New planters have recently been installed and planted, helping to bring a fresh touch of greenery to the town centre and create a more welcoming environment for everyone to enjoy. We look forward to seeing the plants establish and flourish over the coming weeks, adding even more life and colour to the heart of our town."
Several bags of insulation have been found dumped in Gorleston. Numerous black bags stuffed with insulation material have been found at two locations in housing areas in the town. A Facebook post from Great Yarmouth Borough Council Rangers and Recycling said on Monday, 8th of June, "These bags full of insulation were found this morning at two locations in housing areas in Gorleston, Pine Green, Gorleston and Magnolia Green, Gorleston, believed to have dumped between 5:30 and 8 o'clock in the morning."
New data has revealed the high obesity rates in Great Yarmouth. According to a new analysis from the Independent Pharmacy, Great Yarmouth ranks sixth among places facing an obesity-related healthcare strain. The research found 34.1% of adults in Great Yarmouth are affected by obesity, making it among the highest areas in the country. This is alongside an average waiting time of 17 weeks for obesity-related treatment. Dr. Donald Grant, GP, and senior clinical advisor at the Independent Pharmacy said, "Our study highlights the areas where high obesity rates and long NHS waits are combining to create significant pressure on local services. In places where more than one in three adults are living with obesity, demand for support is already high. This is not only a waiting list issue, but a wider prevention challenge. North Lincolnshire and Goole topped the index, with 35.1% of adults classed as obese and similar waiting times."
A man killed when his motorcycle left the road and hit a tree as he rode along a popular biking route through the Broads has been named. Stephen Devon Rami crashed on the A1062, which runs from Potter Heigham to Overton, near the village of Horning, while riding a high-performance Ducati Panigale. The 54-year-old, who worked as a regional claims manager, died at the scene, becoming the ninth biker to be killed on Norfolk's road this year. An inquest into his death opened at Norfolk Coroner's Court on June the 3rd. The brief hearing was told Mr. Rami from Hemsby had died of multiple injuries in the crash on May 26th and was formally identified by his wife, Joanna Rami. Robin Whale, Norfolk's assistant coroner, then adjourned the hearing while investigations continue into the circumstances of the crash. It is due to resume on December the 9th. Police have issued road safety warnings in response to the high number of biker deaths so far this year. They have urged bikers to refresh their skills, while also urging car drivers to do more to help keep motorcyclists safe. The force has also hosted bike safety events. Inspector Will Drummond said, "We have already seen a number of motorcyclists lose their lives on our roads this year, and every one of these incidents is a tragic reminder of how vulnerable drivers can be. We're asking drivers to recognise the vital role they play in preventing further travellers. Look twice at junctions, give motorcyclists space, and be patient on rural roads. A moment of extra care could be the difference between someone getting home safely and a life being lost." One of the other bikers killed this year, also a man in his 50s, died on a crash on the same road, the A1062, also near Horning, on April the 4th.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has said he hopes reform UK-led councils, such as Norfolk County Council, will rethink their decision to take down his country's flag. Norfolk County Council is among the reform-run councils which have lowered Ukrainian flags that were hoisted on civic buildings in response to Russia's 2022 invasion. Reform UK, which now runs County Hall with a minority administration after last month's elections, brought in a new flag policy under which County Hall will display official national, county and civic flags. But Ukraine's president expressed his hope that Norfolk and other reform-led councils, such as Suffolk and Essex, would reconsider. Mr. Zelensky said, "I hope they will put it back. I don't want to be involved in any political things, but you know, the world is so sensitive today. Sometimes little, small mistakes can break big friendship or huge contacts." The Ukrainian leader then suggested that people have not to make mistakes before adding, "Okay, so you did it. Please, let's come back to the table. Let's speak. Let's understand each other." Mr. Zelensky made the comments in an interview in the Guardian newspaper after he had met Sir Keir Starmer and the political leaders of France and Germany, Emmanuel Macron and Friedrich Merz. Norfolk's Reform UK leaders, when they announced County Hall's new flag policy, said it was to reflect the principle that civic buildings should remain politically neutral and represent all residents equally. That policy meant that non-official flags, including the Ukraine flag and the Progress Pride flag, which was raised in Pride Week, will no longer be flown from County Hall. County Council leader David Bick had stressed the removal of the Ukraine flag was not meant to indicate a reduction in support for the country. And in response to Mr. Zelensky's remarks, County Councillor Scott Hussey, Reform's spokesman, said, "President Zelensky is a leader of great courage and conviction, and our support for Ukraine remains unwavering." The recent lowering of the Ukrainian flag at County Hall does not, however, reflect any change in Norfolk's support for Ukraine. Rather, it implements Reform's policy of flying only national and local flags from civic county buildings, a policy we are proud to implement. Whilst we recognise the sensitivities surrounding the Ukrainian flag, County Hall exists to serve the people of Norfolk, and it is not the appropriate venue for making symbolic statements on matters of UK foreign policy.
An independent lifeboat service, which is one storm away from losing its station, has revealed plans for its new headquarters. Hemsby Lifeboat said it is planning to convert the former Hollywood Diner on Beach Road into a new station, shop and community space. The existing station at the Gap sits perilously on erosion-threatened sand dunes, and every year storms wash away the service's ramp access to the beach. But behind the scenes, the charity says they've been planning carefully and responsibly with the service's long-term future in mind. "Over the last 10 years, we've been raising funds for our station, originally to upgrade the current building. But as the situation changed, it became clear the current location would not remain viable, and the search began for a new home," they said. The service confirmed they have recently bought the freehold of the Hollywood Diner, which has been empty for almost 2 years. The plans for the building include a new operational lifeboat station, a new lifeboat shop and public viewing and seating area, and a shared community space for meetings and local events. The lifeboat said it would be a welcoming meeting point for our retired population and others who need a friendly space with light refreshments. The charity admitted the work will take time, but said they have a contingency plan for a fallback station if they need to move quickly, ensuring they can remain on active service. They previously estimated it would cost around £500,000 to convert the former restaurant. An old lifeboat shed that was used by the service for storage was swept away in December 2013 in a storm that was described as the worst tidal surge in 60 years.
The special guests who are joining an international superstar at a UK-exclusive outdoor show in Norfolk have been revealed. Three artists will be joining Lionel Richie as he performs live at Sandringham Estate in Norfolk on Thursday, August the 20th, as part of Heritage Live 2026. Grammy and Brit Award-winning soul singer Joss Stone has been revealed as a special guest, along with Dave Stewart Eurythmics, featuring Vanessa Amorosi and rising star Brooke Combe. Stewart, best known as co-founder of Eurythmics alongside Annie Lennox, brings a catalogue of 1980s synth-pop classics to the stage, with an all-female band and Australian singer Vanessa Amorosi. Stone burst onto the scene in her 2003 debut album, The Soul Sessions, and has since sold over 15 million albums worldwide. She has collaborated with legends including James Brown, Stevie Wonder, Gladys Knight and Sting. Her 2022 Never Forget My Love was written with and produced by Mr. Stewart. Combe, who released her debut album Dancing at the Edge of the World in 2025, has been praised for her soulful sound and has been tipped as one of the UK's most promising new talents. Mr. Richie has sold more than 125 million albums worldwide and is known for timeless hits including All Night Long, Dancing on the Ceiling, Hello and Endless Love. In 2022, he was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and awarded the Gershwin Prize for Popular Song by the American Library of Congress. His show in Sandringham is his only confirmed UK performance for 2026. They join a stellar lineup of headliners for the Heritage Live Festival, including Janet Jackson, Christina Aguilera, Ricky Martin and Eric Clapton.
Everybody sing, everybody dance. Lose yourself in wild romance. We're going to party, caramba, fiesta, forever. Come on and sing along. We're going to party, caramba, fiesta, forever. Come on and sing along.
Another local shop could be banned from selling single cans of alcohol in an effort to reduce street drinking. Police are attempting to impose the measure on Romanesque and Baltic Market on Great Yarmouth's King Street. The street is in an area of the town where police and other agencies are trying to reduce antisocial behaviour associated with street drinking. The shop's licensee, Dorota Wallach, has replied to sell alcohol between 8 a.m. and 10 p.m. in line with its opening hours. However, officers have asked Great Yarmouth Borough Council to impose a restriction that alcohol can only be purchased in multiple packs. The council's own officials have also advised councillors to impose the single can ban. The proposals, including the restrictions called for by police, will be considered by the authority's licensing committee next Friday. And a similar condition was recently imposed on Express Store and Post Office on St Peter's Road.
Great Yarmouth First has said it will fund a legal challenge against the construction of 446 homes in Hopton. John Whedon, leader of the party at Norfolk County Council, says it has the funds to contest the decision by Great Yarmouth Borough Council to approve the huge new development. Yarmouth First, an offshoot of Rupert Lowe's Restore Britain, claims the council did not properly consider the impact the new homes to be built off Lynx Road between Gorston and Hopton would have on infrastructure. In a letter sent to GYBC, Mr Whedon and Barry Gravenal, county councillor for Gorston, said they were starting proceedings for a judicial review. They wrote, "The committee failed to consider the cumulative impact of multiple infrastructure constraints arising from the development, including highways capacity, sewage infrastructure limitations, and the pressure on NHS and other public-facing services." A spokesman for Great Yarmouth Borough Council said, "The council can confirm it has received the letter from Mr Whedon and Mr Gravenal and will be responding in due course. The council is not able to comment on ongoing legal matters." At the meeting last month when the decision was made, Ivan Murray-Smith, Conservative member for Lothingland, said that despite agreeing with the concerns over traffic, he could not see any reasons to disagree with the recommendation from officers that the scheme be improved. The Yarmouth First councillors say the planning committee did not properly engage with planning considerations at the meeting. If the judicial review goes ahead, it would likely put a halt to work at the site. Such reviews can take months and cost significant sums of money. Even the most straightforward cases can cost up to £30,000. Mr Whedon and Mr Gravenal had asked for confirmation that no further steps will be taken on construction until the case is resolved. They are calling on the approval of the 446 homes to be withdrawn. The letter from the councillors adds, "The proposed claimants are willing to consider any appropriate form of alternative dispute solution if the defendant considers that this matter can be resolved without proceedings." Writing on Facebook, Mr Whedon said, "We believe there are serious questions that need answering about how this decision was reached and whether all of the relevant issues were properly considered. That is why we have now started the process towards formal legal action."
Reform UK believe they're on course to take charge of law enforcement in Norfolk after the shock resignation of the county's police boss. David Bick, the Norfolk County Council leader, said his party would expect to win a by-election to find a successor to Sarah Taylor as the Police and Prime Commissioner, the PCC. She quit with immediate effect on Thursday, citing family reasons. The county-wide by-election is expected to cost around £2 million and will raise questions as previous votes have been characterised by turnouts as low as 14%, and the post itself is due to be abolished in less than 2 years. The by-election has not yet been confirmed, with some figures, such as Terry Jeremy, the Labour MP for South West Norfolk, and Stefan Aquarone, North Norfolk's Liberal Democrat MP, questioning whether it should go ahead, given the roll is to be scrapped. The office of the police and prime commissioner itself is waiting for guidance from the Home Office about the by-election in what it says are unprecedented circumstances, although it has suggested a possible date of July the 16th. Mr. Bick acknowledged that a by-election would be an expensive exercise, but said it was necessary. He said a reformed PCC would set a new zero-tolerance approach to policing in the county. Even if you can't get concrete things done, you can set a tone. You can set out what you'd expect from your police force, he said. I make no bones about it. I hope we get a policy of zero tolerance. In a lengthy LinkedIn post late on Thursday night, Miss Taylor said she had suffered multiple bereavements and ill health within her family, and the recent diagnosis of a close relative with a life-changing condition. Kay Mason-Billig, the Conservative councillor who led Norfolk County Council until last month's elections, sits on Norfolk's equivalent panel and said that an extraordinary meeting was being organised to discuss the next steps. She described the prospect of a by-election, which would be funded by central government, as a terrible waste of money. The police force is strapped for cash at the moment. We're constantly asking the force for more funding. They won't fund rural communities as they should. However, she acknowledged that parties would relish the prospect of an election, making one almost inevitable. There's no way that all the parties aren't going to take the chance to get someone into this position, she added. When Miss Taylor was elected in 2024, just 21.3% of Norfolk's electorate cast a vote. In other previous elections, attendance has slumped as low as 14%. Ms. Taylor's departure brings to close a turbulent tenure as the county's first female PCC and the first Labour politician to win a Norfolk-wide vote in decades. She was elected in May 24, beating Conservative incumbent Giles Orpen-Smiley by 52,000 votes to 50,000 votes. However, she later resigned from the Labour Party in November 25, after the government announced it would be scrapping PCCs, a decision Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood described as ending a failed experiment. Her time in the role, which was invented by the coalition government in 2012, was not without controversy. Sources have suggested she was reluctant to stand and did not expect to win, having left a successful career as a highways and transport engineer, including advising the government on smart motorways, to take up the £76,000-a-year role. Her decision to withdraw a £35,000 grant for a specialist domestic abuse legal service drew fierce criticism from victims' advocates, with Norfolk County Council eventually stepping in with £72,000 in replacement funding. Her spell in office has also been marked with an increasing number of scandals involving Norfolk police officers, including one who visited Thai massage parlours for sex, and another who pretended to work from home by holding down keys on a laptop with a bottle of nail varnish. She said that whilst the increased number of misconduct cases may seem alarming, they actually signal a real shift in culture at the force. One of the major issues facing Norfolk Constabulary during her time in office was the repeat protests outside Beauthorpe's Brook Hotel, which put a huge strain on the force. Miss Taylor actively encouraged counter-protesters to attend to oppose those demonstrating against its use as an asylum hotel. She said counter-demonstrators were really welcome. The PCC role comes with an office of 30 staff and an annual budget of £1.8 million. Miss Taylor has also stood down as a Breckland councillor. She stepped down with immediate effect as the Police and Crime Commissioner after suffering the multiple bereavements and the diagnosis of a family member with a life-changing condition.
Officials have cancelled plans to use a 10-bedroom house in Galston to provide emergency accommodation. Norfolk County Council were seeking permission to turn a 2.5-storey property on Clarence Road in Galston into what is termed a house in multiple occupation, HMO. But planners at Great Yarmouth Borough Council have now said that the plans have not been proceeded with. They said the application is invalid because they have not received the necessary information from the County Council. The Borough Council have objected to the plans, saying the accommodation could be substandard. The building had previously been used as supported accommodation for adults with learning disabilities, accommodating 7 people. Catherine Brumpton, Senior Planning Officer at the Borough Council, said, "The proposed layout and accompanying documents raise concerns about the quality of the proposed accommodation. Some rooms are substandard in size. The proposal does not seem to address safeguarding concerns adequately, notably those in relation to young children." The Borough Council has now said that if County Hall wants to pursue the project, the County Council will need to submit a new planning application.
Organisers of Camping It Up by the Coast have announced a change to the lineup for a Pride fundraiser event in Great Yarmouth. Big Tasty will no longer be appearing due to unforeseen commitments on the June 13th event, but RuPaul's Drag Race UK Season 6 star Chara T will be stepping in. Chara T is expected to bring extra sparkle and energy to the evening and will be hosting a dedicated area for fans to purchase official merchandise, get items signed and take photos. A spokesperson for Great Yarmouth and Waveney Pride said, "We're sorry that Big Tasty can't join us, but we're absolutely delighted to welcome Drag Race UK royalty Chara T to our stage. This promises to be an even more unforgettable night of entertainment, sass and celebration by the coast." The fundraiser will be happening on Saturday, June 13th, from 7:30pm to 10:30 at the Ice House on Bridge Road. The event will feature performances from the cast of local entertainers. Profits from the evening will support Great Yarmouth and Waveney Pride, celebrating diversity and inclusion across the region. Tickets are £7 with an 80p booking fee.
A sentencing date has been set for a teen who was arrested for supplying Class A drugs following the death of a 15-year-old girl who had taken ecstasy. Nathan Lafitte, 19, was detained after the death of Lily McCarthy, who died in hospital after falling ill at an address in Hopton in the early hours of Saturday, January the 24th. He was charged with supplying MDMA, the chemical term for ecstasy, with intent. On Tuesday, Lafitte, of no fixed address, appeared at Norwich Crown Court via video link from HMP Norwich, having previously admitted to a single charge of supplying the Class A drug on January the 23rd this year. Judge Anthony Bate fixed a sentencing date for September the 11th. Also appearing in court was 18-year-old Kian Lockett of King Street, Yarmouth. Lockett, who was represented by Ian James, had previously entered a not guilty plea to supplying MDMA on January the 23rd this year. The case had been adjourned for the Crown to consider the position and see whether a trial would be pursued. Ed Renvoys, prosecuting, said the case has been fully reviewed, but it was not the intention of the prosecution to try Mr. Lockett. Lockett has, however, previously admitted an offence of being concerned in the supply of ecstasy in Yarmouth on January the 26th this year. He will also be sentenced on September the 11th. Both defendants were remanded into custody. The devastated family of Miss McCarthy issued a heartfelt tribute to the teen following her death. "Our hearts are completely broken," they said. Lily was a bright, happy and funny girl who made a massive impact on everyone lucky enough to have her in their lives.
A man's bid to turn part of a chicken farm into housing has been refused over concerns about noise from animals. Jeff Perry, whose family has run a farming business since the 1800s, was seeking permission from Great Yarmouth Borough Council to transform an agricultural building at Dole Poultry Farm on Dole's Lane in Bradwell. The scheme would have involved the creation of three single-storey homes, including two with one bedroom and one with two. But planners have refused the proposal. They said the noise from livestock using adjacent land would make it undesirable as a place to live. Another problem was that some of the bedrooms would have suffered from unacceptable levels of outlook and light. The plans had faced two objections, with both Bradwell Parish Council and Councillor Anthony Capewell, who represents the Bradwell South and Hopton ward on the Borough Council, raising concerns about noise, water supply and odour. It was the second time Mr. Perry made the application. Planners rejected an earlier bid last year over fears new residents would be hit by a noise and odour from the working farm, and the planning inspectorate later dismissed an appeal. The site forms part of Dole's poultry farm, and the building is currently in active agricultural use associated with poultry rearing. A design and access statement had said that demand for the poultry unit has dropped in recent years, blaming pressures on the sector and avian flu restrictions, and argued the building is now becoming surplus to requirements. Mr. Perry had applied under Class Q prior approval rules, which allow some farm buildings to be turned into homes without full planning permission, as long as issues such as noise, flooding and highway impact are checked by the council first.
Drivers were faced with long delays on a major road after a car and a lorry collided. The incident happened on the A149 encased on Sea just before 9 a.m. on Monday. Police, fire and ambulance crews attended. A spokeswoman for Norfolk Constabulary said the incident involved a Ford Fiesta and a lorry, and there are not believed to be any injuries.
Strange jelly-like creatures have been washing up on the Norfolk coast. The translucent blobs, known as sea gooseberries, have been spotted along the tide line and in the shallows at Haysborough. According to Haysborough Coast Watch, the creatures are completely harmless to humans. A spokeswoman assured that despite their jelly-like appearance, sea gooseberries are not true jellyfish and do not have stinging cells. Also known as comb jellies, sea gooseberries are oval-shaped and almost entirely transparent, often with delicate trailing tentacles. They move by gliding through the water and feed on plankton. Their recent abundance is linked to seasonal changes. The Coastwatch volunteers say numbers tend to increase during spring and summer when plankton is more plentiful in surface waters. Beachgoers are being urged to treat the creatures with care. If you do pick one up to have a closer look, please be very gentle, as they're around 99% water and easily harmed, the spokeswoman said. They can be gently returned to the sea.
A community centre has temporarily closed its doors in Great Yarmouth while a new organisation is created to take on its management. Cobham Community Centre has been closed for around a month. The centre, which had been leased to Cobham Community Centre Association by Great Yarmouth Borough Council, GYBC, is now closed for the time being after their licence expired. A new group is now being formed to run it. A spokesman for GYBC said, Cobham Community Centre was formerly occupied under a licence from the council, and the premises and all activities were run by the Cobham Community Centre Association. However, that arrangement has now ended. The council understands a new charitable incorporated organisation, CIO, will be created for Cobham Community Centre. CIOs are required to register with the Charity Commission. The new CIO, once registered, will take on the future management of the community centre. Initially, the council will issue a 12-month licence to the CIO to ensure the site can reopen quickly. The council expects the CIO to form a full board in collaboration with the local community, which will establish and operate under a revised constitution. If the centre operations are a success, the council expects a full lease to be provided following the 12-month licence.
A seafront theme park has launched a competition so people can own a part of its history. Joyland in Great Yarmouth is giving people the chance to win a snail wheel and a section of track in its 2026 competition bundle. It comes after the theme park offered a section of an axle from one of the snails in a competition last year. A Facebook post from Joyland said, "For the very first time ever, we're giving you the chance to win a genuine super snail wheel and a section of track as part of our 2026 competition bundle. This is your chance to own a unique piece of Joyland history that has never been available before. Enter now via our website and you could become the first person ever to own a super snail wheel and track. To enter the competition, you need to answer a question correctly, and the winner will be drawn from all the correct entries on July the 20th. And you can find out more about the competition on the Joyland website, www.joylandmerch.co.uk. And Margaret's going to be rushing down to do that.
I remember the snails when I was a child, all they did was shake you about. I can't wait to take my little great-granddaughter on. I'm sure she'd love it. No, I'm too old now, but I do have happy memories.
Well, if you win that, you can have it in your garden and she comes
to you. What would I do, I ask myself?
Entertain your granddaughter.
Oh, indeed, yes. That's a thought. Might stop her chattering so much. Oh, it's lovely. Anyway, rowdy teenagers, which I'm sure she'll not become, rowdy teenagers who have been intimidating volunteers at a playing field will face extra police patrols. The incidents of antisocial behaviour have been occurring at Caister Playing Field over the past few weeks, the parish council has said. Now the body has said that an increased police presence will be introduced to the area. It is hoped that the officers will deter youths from causing trouble at the spot, which is frequented by children and families who use its playgrounds. A spokesman for the organisation, which manages the green space, said, "Whilst we understand these are a minority of Caister teenagers, this is totally unacceptable behaviour, and we have, as a result, asked for extra police presence. We have CCTV in operation, and this has been passed to the police. These individuals will be barred from the field if this behaviour continues, and parents will be informed. Please make sure your children are not involved. If you see any further antisocial behaviour, please report it to Great Yarmouth Police."
And there's to be a new BT Street Hub in Great Yarmouth. Plans have been approved to build this new street hub. Great Yarmouth Borough Council has approved a proposal to install a new BT street hub on the pavement outside 70-18 Broad Row. The plan, submitted by BT Telecommunications PLC, will see the creation of a street hub near Stonecutters Way and will replace a recently removed BT phone box within the same section of footway. It will be a totem design, black in colour, and contain large LED digital advertisement screens on both sides. It will enable the following features: free phone calls, free Wi-Fi, small cell mobile coverage, and digital screens to provide advertisements. Norfolk County Council Highways raised no objection to the plan submitted, and no letters were submitted as part of the public consultation. Planners said the street hub would provide enhancements to the telecommunications network within the town, which outweighs the low-level impact on designated heritage assets. Under approval conditions, the street hub must provide 876 hours of free council advertising each year.
Bin collectors and street cleaners in Great Yarmouth are voting on whether to strike over claims of low pay, with union leaders warning of a summer stink in the town. Great Yarmouth Services, GYS, workers are being balloted until July the 1st, and the vote could lead to industrial action over the summer months. Unite the Union said bin workers, street cleaners, tree surgeons and gardeners are angry at a 3.3% pay offer from GYS, which is owned by Great Yarmouth Borough Council. They say the offer would not give the majority of workers a legal increase to be in line with the minimum wage, which rose by 4.1% in April. Unite General Secretary Sharon Graham said, Great Yarmouth Council is not even offering the majority of these workers a real pay rise. In effect, the council is saying they should be grateful it is even paying them the minimum wage. This is appalling behaviour towards staff doing dirty, difficult work in all weathers, and they're critical to the running of the town. Unite is backing these workers 100%.
The Friends of Great Yarmouth Cemeteries have organised a free guided tree walk. The event, taking place on Thursday, June the 18th, from 2pm to 3:30, will be led by David Riddles, the new Arboricultural Officer at Great Yarmouth Services. Those who come along will be guided through the cemeteries either side of Kitchener Road to learn about the variety of trees growing there and review their condition. The walk will show which trees are suited to this now rare sand dune habitat and why and how the different species of tree are responding to varieties of stress thanks to changing climate and environmental conditions. A particular threat is posed by a disease being spread by oak progressionary moths, which has caused the felling of home oaks in certain regions of the UK. People will also learn about trees that were part of the original cemetery design and those that have self-seeded. The guided walk will begin at Kitchener Road entrance to the Old Cemetery. People interested in the free walk are advised to wear good shoes, as the walk will extend beyond maintained pathways. And that's the last of the news items. But I think we have a couple of items that may be of interest that are not news, they're distinctly older. and I'm not talking about Margaret. That
Thank
would
you.
Be very rude.
I'll slap you later.
No change there then. Right, Margaret, off you
right.
go.
So if you want to know how much a tin of baked beans cost in 1955, I'll tell you later on. Now, this is a message from Diana, who went to St Louis Convent High School, same as me. And I have to say, Diana, I left there in 1959, so I'm 10 years older than you, probably. Did you hate the uniform as much as we did? Oh, dear. And to this day, I can't eat chips on the market in case someone would report me, because we were never allowed to eat on the street in our uniforms. Right. So I shall go on with items from 1955. And first of all, I'll begin with entertainment. Tommy Trinder was at the Windmill, the Beverly Sisters at the Royal Aquarium, Ronnie Ranald at the Wellington. And if you wanted a bit of outdoor excitement, you could go to Norwich and see Speedway, Norwich versus Birmingham. Reserved seats, 5 shillings and 3 and 6 pence, and standing, 2 and 6 pence. Now, I don't remember 1955 very well. I was only in the junior school at the convent, but I can remember my parents and my brother going to the Speedway on Caister Road, and they watched the likes of Ovie Funden and Peter Craven. Oh dear, takes me back. Now, what else was on the entertainment scene? You could pay eightpence to see Eddie Gates play the organ at the Floral Hall in Galston. Oh, the good old Floral Hall. I can just remember they used to slide back the doors so that the people sunbathing and swimming in the pool could hear. And while on the subject, wasn't that pool wonderful? Open air, wide grass verges and two little paddling pools for the youngsters and a little kiosk that sold frothy Horlicks. I had a Horlicks, but only if I behaved myself in the water and didn't splash my little brother. Many happy memories. Now, at the Shoblands Youth and Adult Centre, there was a summer review entitled Let's Go Gay, and seats for that were 3 shillings and 2 shillings. If you wanted to entertain indoors, you could rent a 17-inch black and white TV for 12 and 6 a week from RAP on Hall Quay. Then what could you buy in 1955? Well, you could buy a brand new 2-bedroom bungalow at Caister Sands Estate for £1,400. Garages were £85 extra. Platten's shop had a sale on, and you could buy men's sports shirts for 10 shillings each, Woolsey socks 3 and 11 pence a pair, ladies' vests 1 and 11 pence, hookside corsets, oh my word, 10 and 6 pence. A Whitney blanket for a single bed would cost you 28 and sixpence, and a double, 36 and 11 pence. Arnold's had on offer tomato sauce at 1 and 8 pence a large bottle, luncheon meat 10 pence halfpenny a tin, and here we go, baked beans 8 pence halfpenny per tin, and dry blue peas, whatever they were, at 11 pence per pound. This next item I found hard to believe. Bowers and Barr were selling Electrolux refrigerators for 55 guineas, or 12 shillings a week for 2 years. And there was also a sale on at the Cornhall in Howard Street. Ladies' tweed coats at 70 shillings, and gents' double texture macs also 70 shillings. Now, if you wanted to be adventurous and travel outside the town, Norfolk Motor Services ran coaches to Ipswich for 9 and 3 pence return, Skegness 15 shillings, Clacton 12 and sixpence, and London 15 and ninepence. Now, cars. A 1954 Austin Healey Sprite would set you back £900, and a more sedate 1953 Austin A40 Saloon £550. And what were you listening to in 1955? It was 20 Tiny Fingers by the Stargazers, Everywhere and Mama was David Whitfield, The Man from Laramie, Jimmy Young, and Love Me or Leave Me, Doris Day. Oh, and I can remember It Takes Me Back. We, in our family, we had one of those enormous great wooden radiograms that my mother polished weekly. And that was one heck of a size. But anyway, it played the records, and they were all those 78 things that you could break, so we had to be very careful with them. So that's all my memories for the time being, and I'm glad we sorted out the tin of how much a tin of baked beans was. Eightpence halfpenny, there you go. Thank you.
Well, my piece is possibly a bit longer, and it certainly relates to times beyond 1955. It's another of the pieces that has been taken from Hayden Brown's Norfolk Tales Facebook page, and we are indebted to Hayden for giving us permission to use this. Elizabeth Fry is a name that's associated with Norfolk, and perhaps this piece will help us understand why. Called the Angel of Prisons, Elizabeth Fry was a woman of the 19th century who campaigned for prison reform and social change with a rigour that inspired future generations to continue her good work. Born on 22nd of May 1780 into a prominent Quaker factory from Norwich, her father, John Gurney, worked as a banker, whilst her mother, Catherine, was a member of the Barclay family. And yes, that's the family that founded Barclays Bank. The Gurney family were extremely prominent in the region and responsible for much development in Norwich. Such was the family's affluence that in 1875 it was personified in popular culture by Gilbert and Sullivan, with a quote from Trial by Jury that, "At length I became as rich as the Gurneys." Unsurprisingly, young Elizabeth had a charmed life growing up in Earlham Hall with her brothers and sisters. For Elizabeth, her religious calling was evident from an early age, and her strength of faith was later harnessed to enact social reform. Inspired by the preaching of the American Quaker William Savory and others like him, in her early adulthood, Elizabeth rededicated herself and was on a mission to make a difference. By the tender age of 20, her own personal life was soon blossoming as she met her future husband, Joseph Fry, also a banker and cousin of the famous Fry family from Bristol. Well known for their confectionery, shall we say chocolate, business, they too, like the Gurney family, were Quakers and often involved themselves in philanthropic causes. On the 19th of August 1800, the young couple married and moved to St Mildred's Court in London, where they would go on to have a prolific family of 11 children, 5 sons and 6 daughters. Despite her now full-time role as wife and mother, Elizabeth found time to donate clothes to the homeless as well as serve as a minister for the Religious Society of Friends. The real turning point in her life came in 1813, after a family friend called Stephen Grellet prompted her to visit Newgate Prison. Upon her visit, she was horrified by the conditions she discovered. Unable to stop thinking about the prisoners, she returned the following day with provisions. Some of the harsh conditions Elizabeth would have witnessed included immense overcrowding, with women who were incarcerated forced to take their children with them into these dangerous and distressing living conditions. The space was cramped, confined areas to eat, wash, sleep and defecate in. The harsh reality of the prison world would have been a startling sight for Elizabeth. With the prisons full to capacity, many were still awaiting trial, and a variety of people with extremely varying convictions were held together. Some of the stark differences would have included those women accused of stealing from the market, a long time someone serving time for murder. The conditions were grim, and without assistance from the outside world, either from charities or their own families, many of these women faced the desperate choice of starving, begging, or dying. These harrowing images stayed with Elizabeth, and unable to erase them from her mind, she returned the very next day with clothing and food for some of the women she'd visited. Sadly, due to personal circumstances, Elizabeth was unable to continue some of her work because of financial difficulties incurred by her husband's family bank during the financial panic of 1812. Thankfully, by 1816, Elizabeth was able to resume her charity work and focused on Newgate Women's Prison by providing the funds for a school within the prison to educate the children who were living inside with their mothers. As part of a broader programme of reform, she started the Association for the Improvement of Female Prisoners of Newgate, which included providing practical assistance as well as religious guidance and assisting the inmates in discovering routes to employment and self-improvement. Elizabeth Fry had a very different understanding as to the function of a prison compared to many of her peers of the time. Punishment was the 19th century, was first and foremost, and a rigorous system was the only method for wayward individuals. Meanwhile, Fry believed the system could change, encourage reform, and provide a stronger framework, all of which she endeavoured to do through lobbying with Parliament, campaigning, and charity work. Some of the more specific requirements she concerned herself with after her numerous visits to the prison included ensuring men and women would be separated, with female guards provided for the female inmates. Moreover, after witnessing so many individuals serving time for such a broad spectrum of crimes, she also campaigned for housing of criminals to be based on the specific crime. She focused her efforts on encouraging the women to gain new skills, which could help better their prospects of upon leaving the prison. She gave practical advice on hygiene matters, religious instruction from the Bible, taught them needlework and gave comfort in some of their most difficult moments. While some individuals warned Fry of the perils she may incur while visiting such dens of iniquity, she took the experience in her stride. Elizabeth Fry's concern for the prisoners' welfare and experiences within the confines of the prison wall also extended to the circumstances of their transportation, which often included being paraded through the streets in a cart and being pelted by the people of the town. In order to stop such a spectacle, Elizabeth campaigned for more decent transportation, such as covered carts, and visited about 100 transport ships. Her work would eventually lead to the formal abolition of transportation in 1837. She remained determined to wish a tangible change in the structure and organisation of the prisons, so much so that her published book, Prisons in Scotland and the North of England, gave details of her nightly visits in such facilities. She even invited titled individuals to come and see the conditions for themselves, including, in 1842, Frederick William IV of Prussia, who met with Fry in Newgate Prison on an official visit, which greatly impressed him. Moreover, Elizabeth benefited from the support of Queen Victoria herself, who admired her efforts in improving the lives and conditions of those most in need. In doing so, her work helped to increase public awareness as well as garnering the attention of the lawmakers in the House of Commons. In particular, Thomas Foxwell Buxton, Elizabeth's brother-in-law, who also served as MP for Weymouth, proved instrumental in promoting her work. In 1818, she also became the first woman to provide evidence to a House of Commons committee on the subject of prison conditions, ultimately leading to the Prison Reform Act of 1823. Her campaigning helped to change attitudes as her unorthodox approach began to yield positive results, leading some to believe that her rhetoric of rehabilitation could be more effective. She chose to promote her ideas across the English Channel, in France, Belgium, Holland and Germany. While she encouraged prison reform, her humanitarians continued elsewhere, as she sought to tackle a variety of social issues. She helped to improve the lives of the homeless by setting up a shelter in London and opening up soup kitchens after seeing the dead body of a young child who did not survive a brutal winter night. Her attention extended specifically to helping willing, particularly fallen women, by providing them with accommodation and opportunities to find other sources of employment. Elizabeth's desire for better overall conditions in different institutions also included proposed reforms in mental asylums. Her focus was widespread, tackling social issues that had previously been taboo topics. Alongside her fellow Quakers, she also supported and worked with those who were campaigning for the abolition of slavery. By the 1840s, she had founded a nursing school in order to improve the education of nursing standards of those in training, serving to inspire Florence Nightingale, who worked alongside fellow nurses to help the soldiers of the Crimean War. Elizabeth Fry's work was outstanding, groundbreaking and inspiring for a new generation who wanted to continue her good work. In October 1845, she passed away, with more than 1,000 people attending her memorial. A legacy was later to be recognised when she was depicted on the £5 banknote in the early 2000s. Elizabeth Fry was a woman born into a prominent family with wealth and luxury, who chose to use her position to better the lives of others, drawing attention to the social tragedies across the country and raising a social conscience in the public, which had been somewhat lacking. And if I may add a personal opinion, perhaps today's world would be better for having a few more people with a similar social conscience, prepared to look out for others in less fortunate circumstances. There seem to be too many dog-eat-dog attitudes around these days, not least in certain politicians. Margaret agreed with that too. I got a nod.
And you got the thumbs up.
And the thumbs up. But that didn't show, so I had to tell.
Sorry.
And that, I think, is the end of this week's offering. Goodbye.
Well, that's it for this week. Grapevine is copyright 2026 of the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association. News content is adapted mainly from the Great Yarmouth Mercury. However, the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association accept responsibility for editorial decisions made for this recording. Next week, your newsreaders will be Alison and myself, so we hope that you will join us then for much more of your local news. But in the meantime, here's hoping you stay safe and well. So from all your friends at Grapevine, have a good week, and it's bye for now. Bye.